The Science Inside Podcast.
This is The Science Inside.
Welcome to The Science Inside, where we bring you the latest news, stories, and events happening in the world of science and tech. Good evening, I'm your host, Bridget Lebere. This week, we tackle a rather bloody matter, but one that could potentially save your life. Blood is a life source, a fluid that transports nourishment from the digestive and endocrine glands throughout the body. It also transports disease-fighting substances to the tissue and also removes waste from the kidneys to all over the body, where it gets back to the heart. It gets pumped throughout the body, where it's, you know, it's cleansed in the heart, and then the process starts all over again. And this, mind you, happens on a daily basis. Now, blood contains living cells, meaning blood is alive, and unlike medications that are manufactured, blood cannot. Therefore, healthy donors are required to donate life-giving blood to those whose lives depend on. Now, for a transfusion to be successful, patient and donor blood types must be compatible. Now, we all know that certain blood types, such as AB plus, can only donate to AB plus blood types, and that the O blood type is especially important in emergency rooms, because nurses and doctors can transfer this blood almost immediately in emergency situations, because they do not necessarily have the luxury of time to determine an accident victim's blood type. Now, with this being said, the exciting news is that chemical biologist researchers at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada, analyzing bacteria in the human gut, have discovered that there are microbes that produce two enzymes that can convert the common type A into a more universally accepted type. And should this process work out as projected, blood specialists suggest it could totally revolutionize blood donation and transfusion completely. Like it could just turn it on its head. Now, blood supply shortages happen all over the world, and with a country such as ours with high fertility rates on our roads, it is a great relief to learn that scientists are working on a solution to transform the second most common blood type A into a universally accepted blood type, such as the O blood type. Now, we bring you all that and more later on the show. And on Unscience this week, we look at a rather chilling and rare but extremely distressing phenomenon where patients have been found to be conscious during CPR. Still on the bloody issue, we unpack a blood condition called hemochromatosis, where one can either genetically inherit it or acquire it through overuse of iron supplements and blood transfusions. This anomaly is the overload of iron in the blood, which can lead to a myriad of problems. But that's where I will leave it for now on the Science Inside. We will get more into these topics later on in the show. But right now, we go into the news with Masibulele Lunika.
This week's Science Headline.
In the news making headlines this week, two new Earth-like planets discovered near Tea Gardens star, and IBM expands its quantum computing program with WITS as its first partner in Africa. Good evening, I'm Masibulele Lunika. A University of Göttingen led research team has discovered two new Earth-like planets near one of our closest neighboring stars. The Tea Garden star, rather, is only about 12.5 light years away from Earth and is one of the smallest known stars. It is only about 2.7 degrees Celsius warm and about 10 times lighter than the Sun. Remarkably, it was only discovered in 2003, even though it is so close to Earth. It has been under scientific observation for about 3 years, and their data clearly shows the two planets resemble the inner planet planets of our solar system. Lead author Matthias Zechermeister of the Institute of Astrophysics, says the planets are slightly heavier than Earth and are located in the habitable zone where water can be found in liquid form. Astronomers, however, suspect that the two planets could be part of a larger solar system, according to co-author Professor Stefan Dresler. Apparently, many stars are surrounded by systems with several planets, and so far, the Tea Garden star, which is the smallest star whose weight researchers have been able to measure directly, one of the scientific directors of the project, Professor Ansgar Reyners, lauded this discovery as a great success for the Kamenes project. The new planets are the 10th and 11th discovered by the team. Although planetary systems around similar stars are known, they have always been detected using the undiscoverable transit method, where planets have to pass visibly in front of the star and darken it for a moment. And this only happens in a very small fraction of all planetary systems. And such transits have not yet been found for the new planets. However, the system is located at a special place from Tea Garden Star, where one can see the planets of the solar system passing in front of the sun. Reyners added that using the transit method, inhabitants of the new planets would be able to view the Earth, should they take up the opportunity. The Kamenes project is a collaborative effort between organizations. In our second story, IBM has announced the expansion of its quantum computing efforts to Africa in a new collaboration with Wits University. In South Africa, the university is the first African partner to the IBM Q network and will be the gateway for academics across South Africa and to the 15 universities who are part of the African Research Universities Alliance, ARUA. This is the latest outcome of the joint partnership between IBM Research and WITS, which started in 2016 when IBM opened its second lab in Africa at the WITS University's Chimolokong Digital Innovation Precinct in Johannesburg. To expand the IBM Q network to include WITS will drive innovation in frontier technologies and benefit African-based researchers, academics, and students who now have access to decades of quantum computing capabilities at the click of a button, said Professor Zeblon Vilakazi, WITS Deputy Vice Chancellor for Research and Postgraduate Affairs. Quantum computing promises to be able to solve certain problems, such as chemical simulations and types of optimization that will be beyond the practical reach of classical machines. IBM first made quantum computers available to the public in May 2016 through its IBM Q Experience Quantum Cloud service and has doubled the power of its quantum computers annually since 2017. IBM also established the IBM ThinkQ, or rather IBM Q Network, a community of Fortune 500 companies, startups, academic institutions, and research labs working with IBM to advance quantum computing and explore practical applications for business and science. Researchers at WITS will investigate the use of quantum computing and machine learning in the fields of cosmology and molecular biology, with a specific focus rather on HIV drug discovery. The teams will also jointly study quantum teleportation, a field pioneered by IBM fellow Charles Bennett. For Africa to remain competitive for the coming decades, we must get the next generation of students quantum ready, said Dr. Solomon Assefa, Vice President for Emerging Market Solutions and Director at IBM Research Africa. Having access to IBM Q is pivotal for WITS University's cross-disciplinary research program and allows our researchers in quantum computing, artificial intelligence, and in broad natural sciences, including in laser technology, quantum optics, and molecular design, to leverage the next level of discovery research. It's envisioned that the first results from this collaboration will be forthcoming in the next 2 years, said Professor Vilagazi. Recapping your top stories this hour, two new Earth-like planets discovered near Tea Garden Star, and IBM expands its quantum computing program with WITS as its partner, first partner in Africa.
Well, thank you so much, Masi. If you don't figure Mars to be the planet that you'd like to live on, maybe these two new planets could be place where you and I could live. I'm sorry, I'm not going there, sorry. But maybe, Masi, you'd like to go on a voyage to one of these planets?
Not on a voyage, because I'm increasingly getting worried, because now we are having more problems climate-wise, and there's been a lot of plastics in the sea. Environmentally, there's quite a lot of concern with like a lot of damage that people are doing on the Earth, and maybe with no time we'll need to find a new planet, and you'll see Armageddon sooner than late. So yeah. I think it's a good discovery to actually see which planets we can destroy next after we finish with the Earth.
Oh, you're looking forward to destroying these new planets.
I mean we are doing that, definitely. I think we should actually have more concern and care for our environment, because I mean, why should we even be looking for other planets in the first place?
Oh well, we found out what the possibilities could be should scientists be able to convert the blood type A to a universal type. Stay listening, you don't want to miss this one.
This is the Science Inside.
Welcome back. You're still with the Science Inside. Now we are going into a topic that is going to be going into a number of issues concerning blood. And the most outstanding one that caught our attention for this week is the idea that the second most common blood type A can be converted into the most common one, which is the universal one, which is blood type O. And in an attempt, and this is an attempt to make universally accepted blood more accessible, especially in cases where the supply of this blood type is in short supply. So right now on the line, we have operations testing manager Charles Coleman of the South African National Blood Services, who has been working in the blood transfusion science environment for the past 22 years. His responsibilities include safety and screening of approximately 600,000 units of blood per donation annually. Now that's tons, a hell of a lot of blood. He holds two bachelor's degrees and a master's degree in biomedical technology. Shao, good evening and welcome to the Science Inside.
Thank you, Bridget.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Well, Shao, I'm just going to get into it. Now, earlier on, we also spoke to a hematology professor, and we also asked him about this about this possibility, and then he said, you know, when he talked about it, he said this is an idea, and it's, you know, a great idea, but to me it didn't strike me like he was somebody who was sure or aware that there's research. He knows there's research going on, but if it's something that is being carried out right now, and I'm speaking to you right now because I would like to find out how far are we in South Africa with this research. In your unit, are you conducting such studies, if any?
So currently, South African National Blood Service are not doing research of this kind in South Africa, but we are very aware of the research that is being done. It's actually the conversion of blood types into blood group O through enzymes. It's actually not a new concept. It's actually been first proven as a concept way back in 1982 already by Dr. Jack Goldstein and his team from the Kilgore Research Institute in New York.
Sure.
They actually converted blood group B into blood group O by using enzymes that they extracted from coffee beans at that time. Similarly, that can be done for blood group A, but blood group A is actually a little bit more challenging to do than the initial studies that he done on the blood group B. But currently, yes, there's still a lot of research ongoing. There are commercial interests in this. There are companies specializing and trying to look for the solution of this. But like all research, that can take a lot of time. They need to do clinical trials and prove that there's no harm to patients and that the enzymes convert the A or the B blood group or even AB into O effectively, and that it's safe for patients to use. And clinical trials for certain blood groups have been done, but it's still ongoing. Currently, it's not being done yet for any patients by any blood transfusion service.
And this research, has any of this research been carried in South Africa?
No, not as far as I'm aware. There's no research currently like that in South Africa.
Okay, and from your perspective, something like this, how long could it take? I mean, how far are we in terms of, you know, the trials being run and, you know, the possibility of it happening? Is it something that could take maybe 10, 20 years or so?
Sorry, I lost you there for a while.
Okay, I was just saying that this study, is it something that is feasible? Is it something that could take us 10 to 20 years or in the next 50 years or something?
It's definitely feasible because the research has been enhanced a lot by newer enzymes that they're deriving from bacteria, which is a lot more specific and it's a lot more effective in actually stripping the sugars off the red cell surface. So they've made a lot of progress on this research. I think we should watch this space definitely in the next 5 to 10 years probably.
Okay, 5 to 10 years is something that I can look forward to. And the eventuality of something like this happening, what would this mean to an organization such as yours and the people that you provide, the kind of services that you provide for?
Well, as you said, Blood Group O is obviously what they call the universal donor. Most people in South Africa is actually of the blood group O.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing with blood group O is that it is higher in demand because you can actually give blood group O to anyone that is blood group A or B or AB.
Yes.
The ABO blood group will be compatible. There are a lot of other blood groups though that still comes into play because the ABO blood group and the RH are the main blood group systems, but they are actually a lot of blood group systems that is in play, and that's why blood always gets cross-matched to patients, not because there's actually various antibodies or reactions that can happen. You need to make sure there's compatibility between the product and that you're going to give the patient.
Okay, and we as I had mentioned, that we also spoke to Professor Mahlangu about something within the same category, but just on a different note. He also noted that, you know, with the assistance of tech, we have been able to manufacture artificial organs such as the heart and the kidney. And by that, I mean, you know, the dialysis machine and the life support machine, but we have never been able to create blood in the lab. Why do we still struggle with this, given the tech that we have?
Well, it's partially true. It has actually been done, but on an experimental level, that blood was created or or in a laboratory. So if you look at what he's referring to, like organs, and that refers to stem cell technology.
Yes.
And similarly, you can, and it has been done, that stem cells were used to actually, if you can call it, reduce red cells in the laboratory. But that is on a small scale at this stage. It is not a commercial application at all. And yes, it can definitely be something for the future. There's a lot of focus still on that field, and stem cell research is one of the biggest research fields probably in the world, and especially with organs and blood at this point.
Okay, now still on that topic of, you know, manufacturing our own blood, could you talk us through other blood options or other alternatives? Let's say somebody doesn't want to receive a blood donation for cultural, religious, or personal reasons. Are there other options of, you know, supplementing their blood should they need blood in instances where it's an emergency?
Blood is an essential medicine and still the gold standard for, in the case of blood loss, especially like trauma, where someone loses a lot of blood. Blood substitutes is a field that is a research field on its own, and there are substitutes available or in research or that has been tested. There's basically different categories. There's chemically based blood substitutes, which has limited ability but can also have its own side effects that you have to deal with. And then there's research into hemoglobin-based substitutes where they actually still get the hemoglobin molecule from human origin or from bovine origin, but also they can recombinantly manufacture the hemoglobin molecule. That is the second substitute field, and then the stem cell derived, as I mentioned, is the third one, which they are looking at. In terms of, it depends what the situation of the patient, obviously. If the patient is going to go for an operation that is planned, the doctor can definitely try to preempt that and give the make sure the patient is in the optimal state in terms of his hemoglobin, and you can also make sure that maybe the chance that the patient will get blood is minimized. But in case where, as you said, in rapid blood loss or accident or trauma or postpartum hemorrhage or something, that will be the substitutes are limited and blood will still be the main treatment for all of those.
Amazing. And, well, in South Africa, it is illegal to sell anybody organ or blood, but the blood that your organization receives or it receives from the donors, is it sold to private and public hospitals? It's something that I've always, you know, thought of asking.
That's a question we hear a lot, or a lot of people ask. And I must state that blood is not, you're not allowed to charge or sell blood, as because blood is actually classified as an organ as well.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, it's a live product. But the patients do get charged when they receive blood in public and government sector. And what they are charged for is actually the services related to the product and the value add that the South African National Blood Service or similar organizations add to the product. SANBUS, for instance, have more than 2,000 employees There's blood banks that we have to purchase to get the collections. There's transport and logistics. There's a lot of processing of the blood that happens. We have world-class testing facilities that actually use the best tests for HIV, hepatitis B, and hepatitis C that is available in the world. And then further, when the patient needs to receive blood, they need to have a compatibility test prior to issuing them blood. So as you can hear, there's a whole value chain before blood gets to a patient from the donor side right up to the patient. And that is the related services that goes into blood. And that is what that services are recovered from patients receiving blood.
Okay. And my final question for this interview, what kind of challenges is your organization facing as far as, you know, testing this blood, ensuring that, you know, the blood receives, reaches the end user in, you know, a safe way, and that the blood is of good quality, and maybe just some of the challenges with the donors themselves?
I think there's along the whole value chain, there's constant evaluation and redesign of systems if we see there's shortages of any sort. But the challenges, I think that the main challenges that we face is that blood is always there's always a high demand for blood, and the blood product is not something you can shelve for long.
Mm-hmm.
The expiry dates are relatively short. A red blood cell in the region of 35 days, which is not that long. Blood platelets, which is a high demand product to someone that's bleeding, has an expiry of 5 days, and the longest product shelf life is about a year for plasma that can be frozen. So as you can hear, dealing with products that expire quickly, you always have to have a turnover and try to meet the demand. So this balance between supply and demand, I think, is always one of the biggest challenges. We also move blood around to have it the most equitable way. If we have more blood in let's say the Gauteng region and less blood in Mpumalanga, we will move blood around so that all patients can receive blood in an equitable fashion. I think that's part of our challenges, our day-to-day challenges. Further to that, there's still I think when we talk about testing, and also on the patient side, I think the HIV burden in South Africa is still high, and that definitely is one of our challenges. We have a whole process to ensure that blood is really the safest blood that you can receive, I would say, in the world almost, which starts from the donor collection side with questioning of the donor and for the donor safety itself, but also for the patient safety. And then I think, as I mentioned, we have state-of-the-art testing facilities that test for viruses and bacteria, and sterile procedures to ensure the products of the highest standard.
Okay. Thank you so much for those insights. I think it was a really interesting interview, and I learned something from speaking to you. And that was Operations Testing Manager Charl Coleman from the South African National Blood Services. And he was talking about, you know, some of the challenges that they are faced with till today, where demand and supply is still a burden. And and we learned that in the next 5 to 10 years, we could see the possibilities of a new blood type, in a sense that the blood type A will be converted to a universal blood type, which can be accessible to all people who or patients who may need the life-saving blood. But next up, we unravel the mysteries behind why some patients who are conscious during CPR may suffer immense pain and trauma in unscience.
You're listening to The Science Inside, bringing you science around major news events.
It's time for Unscience, where we look at the strangest side of research and we take a peek at what scientists spend a lot of their time, effort and money on. Today's Unscience was produced by myself. And I'm going to talk about a rare but extremely distressing phenomenon.
Unusual, unlikely, Unscience.
Well, as I said, I'm going to be speaking about a really chilling but rare and extremely distressing phenomenon.
Yeah. Ooh, I don't know if that sounds exciting or scary. I'm looking forward to it. Definitely.
Yeah, it's a bit of both. But it's about patients being conscious during CPR.
Whoa, yeah.
Yeah, so new research by Dr. Rune Langsgaard and her team was presented at the Anesthesia Congress in Copenhagen, Denmark. And this was last year to raise awareness about a rare but extremely distressing phenomenon where patients were being resuscitated during cardiac arrest.
That can be good, but how is that even possible?
Well, that's a good enough question to ask, but while awareness during cardiopulmonary resuscitation is an extremely rare event, it has been reported in medical literature.
Reported in medical literature, you said. Have there been any recent cases?
Well, the case of a 69-year-old male who was admitted to hospital after suffering symptoms of indigestion for 3 days was investigated. He reported feeling breathless a few hours before arrival with any other complaints. But during admission, he experienced a short period of tachycardia, that is rapid heart rate, followed by cardiac arrest. So medical staff immediately, of course, began performing CPR in the form of chest compressions and the provision of oxygen through a mask. And by the time the cardiac resuscitation team arrived, the patient had blood oxygen levels of 100% and a high level of awareness with open eyes and movement of the head and the limbs.
No, God, please, no, 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 no!
Gosh, what happened next?
Well, regular checks were made to see if the patient's heart had begun to beat, but these showed no rhythm and no noticeable movement of the heart was observed during the multiple ultrasound echocardiograms. The patient was intubated to ensure a clear airway and epinephrine is the adrenaline, and it was given every 3 to 5 minutes in an attempt to restore a pulse and spontaneous blood circulation. But after an hour of treatment, an ultrasound scan of the region around the heart was performed, which raised suspicion of aortic dissection. So aortic dissection is a serious and usually fatal condition in which the inner and outer layers of the large artery disintegrate as blood is being forced between those arteries.
Ouch, that sounds painful. I mean, so that means he died, right?
Yes, because despite their best efforts to save the man's life, the man died later, and an autopsy indicated that he had actually suffered a complete aortic dissection. The researchers later concluded that the high level of patient awareness plus oxygen saturation and arterial gas being almost within the normal range throughout the 90 minutes of the treatment indicated that peripheral and cerebral blood flow was good and the chest compressions were highly effective. They also noted that even though the patient had a poor prognosis, the termination of CPR 90 minutes later raised ethical questions among the team members because the individual was conscious at the time.
Creepy, if you ask me. And I mean, what a terrible and painful way to die.
Yep, a previous study from 2014 showed that survivors of cardiac arrest experience a range of cognitive issues as well, with 2% exhibiting full awareness, which can turn lead to post-traumatic disorder, stress disorder, I mean. And of course, regardless of whether or not the person survives, awareness during CPR would be extremely traumatic up to the moment of death should the person die.
What are they going to do about this now that they have learned that, you know, this is highly possible, even though it is deemed to be rare?
Well, Lungsgaard added that they needed to pay further attention and research on the area of sedation during CPR because of most of the times medical professionals do not attend to the pain at the moment of performing the CPR, and they are not aware that they might be causing pain while doing CPR because chances are that patients are fully conscious.
Well, that was definitely extremely distressing and rare phenomenon.
Yeah, very chilling, I must say. But yes, that was unusual, unlikely, unscience.
Unusual, unlikely, unscience. This is the Science Inside.
Welcome back to the Science Inside, and if you have just joined us, we are in the second half of the show, and we are going to unpack hemochromatosis, which is the opposite of another blood condition called anemia. This condition is an overload of iron in the body, the over excess of iron, something which can be inherited, so meaning it runs in your genes, and it can be acquired through receiving multiple blood transfusions, taking iron shots or injections, or just by simply consuming high levels of iron supplement tablets or injections or something like that. Some of the genetic disorders that result in iron overload, which are hereditary hemochromatosis, are the African iron overload known as sickle cell disease, X-linked side thromboblastic anemia. So to look closely at this subject, we spoke to Professor Johnny Mahlangu, who is a head of school of pathology and professor of hematology here at WITS. He's also the director of the World Federation of Hemophilia International Hemophilia Training Center in Johannesburg, as well as the director of Bleeding Disorders Unit and Clinical Hematology Service at Charlotte Maxeke Hospital. And Masibulele Lunika has more on the story.
A lot of people out there are quite familiar with anemia, commonly caused by iron deficiency in the blood and leaving affected individuals tired and short of breath. Joni N. Mahlangu, professor on hematology and clinical hematologist at the Charlotte Maxeke Johannesburg Academic Hospital and the head of School of Pathology at the University of the Witwatersrand and National Health Laboratory Service, says much least commonly known is the other side of anemia, where one experiences excess amounts of iron in their body, which can also be quite dangerous. A lack of hemoglobin, a red protein responsible for transporting oxygen in the blood, is also quite responsible for the causes, according to Professor Mahlangu. He explains further and what the opposite of anemia is and what it means.
Iron and hemoglobin are not the same. You need iron to form the hemoglobin. So iron is a component of the hemoglobin. If you've got deficiency of iron, logically, that will lead to deficiency of the hemoglobin, that will lead to anemia. If you have an excess of iron, which is the other spectrum that you are referring to, strictly speaking, it shouldn't be called anemia. It's actually called polycythemia. And so the condition is uncommon, but it does exist where, for a variety of reasons, the body seem to be keeping the iron in the body, resulting in an excess amount of iron forming an increased amount of hemoglobin, and therefore your hemoglobin goes up. Hemochromatosis is slightly different. The opposite of anemia is polycythemia, whereas hemochromatosis is the natural tendency of the body to retain iron. and the body then finds its use, and in the process of finding its use, it increases the hemoglobin. So it's slightly different, and there are various causes of hemochromatosis. Again, you know, some of those causes can be genetic. There is a familial form of hemochromatosis in which generations in the family will tend to have the hemochromatosis, or you can actually have an acquired form. In fact, in the olden days when we used to use iron pots, it used to be a fairly common reason why people have got more iron than they need.
According to him, the same iron found in iron pots is actually the same as the one found in the blood.
It is exactly the same. I mean, obviously it's not as raw as you are thinking, but ultimately in the olden days when generations after generations used to use the iron pots, the natural adaptation would be for the body to start accumulating the iron, which is leaching out of the iron pots. Nowadays it's very uncommon. It used to be called Bantu siderosis. That was the official name for it.
He explains more on the causes of iron excess in your body.
There are various causes for it, both congenital, in other words, someone is born with it, or acquired conditions. Some of the more common acquired conditions would include, for example, someone with a lung problem, the so-called COPD, the chronic pulmonary condition in which the body senses that you are actually lacking the oxygen. So in response to that, it starts forming more and more hemoglobin. And that, in fact, results in an increase in the hemoglobin level, which is the one mechanism by which you form polycythemia. The other acquired conditions, in fact, tend to be associated with malignancies. In general, polycythemia vera is one of the so-called myeloproliferative disorders in which you produce a little bit more than what you need in your body.
According to the professor, the body has a natural way of keeping the balance. He elaborates.
Normally, there is a balance in the body. We're talking here about extremes, both ways, whether the extreme of you not having enough iron or the extreme of accumulating too much iron. So both of those represent pathological conditions. Under normal physiological conditions, there is a balance in the body, and there are a number of enzymes with fancy names that allow the body to only absorb the amount of iron that it needs. And if it is getting excess iron, it's able to get rid of it. And that balance is called iron metabolism or iron homeostasis. When you get anemia, in fact, that homeostasis has now been imbalanced by the fact that the mechanism that is natural, that is physiological, is no more coping. And the same with excess iron. The mechanism stops actually protecting the individual. In fact, you start having more iron than what you need. Yeah. The body has a way of getting rid of the excess iron.
In terms of treatment and preventative measures, he says there are a few ways, all depending on how the condition started or the underlying reason.
It depends on the underlying cause. Let's start with iron deficiency. Now, I mentioned three mechanisms by which you get to be iron deficient. If the underlying cause is that you do not have iron in your body and therefore you're unable to form hemoglobin and therefore you get anemic, just giving you iron will correct that state. So the one scenario where, in fact, that is very common is when you've got excessive blood loss. When you lose blood, you lose the hemoglobin together with the iron that it carries. So it is the iron replacement that changes that scenario. The second scenario is when you are breaking down the cells, the red cells, in the process called hemolysis. In that scenario, in fact, you're not losing iron, actually, because if you're breaking down and the breakdown happens in the body, in what we call intravascular hemolysis, so the iron that you release from the broken down red cells is actually recirculated in the body. So you don't become iron deficient. In fact, there is no need for you, if you're having a hemolytic process, to have iron supplementation. And then the third scenario, when you're actually losing blood. When you're losing blood, you lose red cells, which have iron, and depending on how quick or slow the process is, if it is an acute blood loss, because hemoglobin is important in supplying oxygen to the vital organs, such as the brain, etc., the best way to replace that blood loss is to get a transfusion. And I'm sure you'll have a show about the importance of donation and blood transfusion. But that is only limited to scenarios where you've got an acute blood loss. If you've got a chronic blood loss, you can transfuse, but we prefer that, in fact, we identify the underlying cause. If the underlying cause is iron deficiency, we normally just give you the iron supplementation without actually giving you the transfusion. That is the one extreme. That is the management of the deficiency. The management of the excess iron is a little bit of a tricky one. You have to actually get into the body what you call iron chelators. These are substances that have an affinity for iron, and they bind iron. And as a result of that binding, in fact, they make it unavailable for it to be deposited in various organs. Iron is very toxic. So if it gets deposited in the heart, in the kidneys, or anywhere in the body, wherever it's deposited, in fact, that organ gets damaged. So we use iron chelators to remove the iron. And that is the way we treat the excess iron, the hemochromatosis. By and large, any healthy individual, by healthy we mean relatively free of disease, should not have anemia. And in that scenario, in fact, there's nothing to worry. In fact, you don't need to do anything because the body regulates your hemoglobin automatically without you actually having to put any effort into it. Once you go into a pathological state where you are sick for whatever reason, your best bet would be check your hemoglobin quite early and in fact correct it quite early.
The professor further explains in terms of the prevalence of hemochromatosis as opposed to anemia.
Anemia is very prevalent. It's very common. Just to give you a piece of useless statistics, if you took the global population, I think it's about 7.2 or 7.4 at the moment, billion people around the world, about 30% of that actually are anemic. And a significant proportion of that 30%, I would say in excess of 70%, would have iron deficiency anemia. So iron deficiency anemia is the commonest cause of anemia in the world. So South Africa, being part of the world, certainly will have the same problem that the rest of the world has. Polycythemia and the hemochromatosis are less common. In fact, the frequency of polycythemia and hemochromatosis is sometimes so low that people even forget that they do exist. But we do have individuals that accumulate excess iron, and that needs to be managed. But it's not, the numbers are not the same. If you take, for example, the ward upstairs, which I run, at any given time, we've got between 5 and 10 people who come to us because of anemia, nothing else, just they're feeling tired and check their hemoglobin is very low.
Lastly, Professor Mahlangu briefly describes the process of detecting these conditions and how the blood is tested to when it is transfused.
Diagnosis is usually very objective. You measure your hemoglobin with one of the machines, and your hemoglobin is low. And you need to actually be helped. In other words, bring that hemoglobin up. So we'll have to take your blood sample We send it to the blood bank. At the blood bank, they do cross-match. They want to find a unit of blood that is compatible with your blood. And once they've identified that unit of blood, then they dispatch it to be given to you. So in the ward or wherever you are, you then receive that blood through a drip. That's the process that you follow. It's a very simple cross-matching, which is then followed by the infusion.
That was it for the story. Thanks to Professor Mahlangu for the insightful interview. I'm Masibulele Luniga.
This is the Science Inside.
And so, as the words of Mark Twain go, I was gratified to be able to answer promptly, and I did. I said, I didn't know. But hey, guess what? Now you know. I believe this show has been particularly eye-opening, and I hope that we have empowered you with some information on how you can possibly save your life or another person's life with just some of the information that was shared on the show. But that is it for this week. A big thank you to all of our guests who were featured on tonight's show, including Professor Johnny Mahlangu and Charles Coleman. Our team behind the scenes is Masibulele Lunika, and tech is, of course, Kutlwano Sera. You can find this week's show on podcastjournalism.co.za/science. The Science Inside is produced by the Wits Radio Academy, funded in part by the South African Department of Science and Technology. Cheers.
Stay curious. Stay informed. Stay on the Science Inside.
The Science Inside Podcast.